Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for January the 20th, 2020. This is Air Force veteran David Corey, along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. I note that a few days ago we passed our third year mark here on BBS Radio Station 1. It's been our privilege for the last 3 years to be on BBS Radio, and thank the station and Doug and Don Newsom, the owners, for this opportunity to be on their great network, and we look forward to many years ahead. Tonight we have lots of news and information of interest to veterans and their families, so we hope you'll stay tuned. First, though, let's turn things over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David. Good evening, everybody. Hope everybody's enjoying this shot of winter. We're getting some here in Florida. A brisk 35 degrees outside. Anyway, yeah, it's 3 years. We've really enjoyed the show. We've had a lot of great guests on our show, and hopefully we've been able to provide you veterans with some valuable information for your own situation dealing with the VA and the Board of Veteran Appeals, and some giving you some insight into the Appeals Modernization Act and everything that's transpired over the last 3 years. And tonight we're going to talk about recent news about from the VA, and we're going to continue our discussion about some some of the biggest changes in the VA disability benefits program this past year, which will affect you veterans. The Appeals Modernization Act went into full effect this past February 19, 2019, and we'll continue our discussion from prior shows about many changes which have resulted from that law, including new forms and new rules for claims and appeals. We'll also discuss new appeal procedures for the Board of Veteran Appeals. We're going to talk about the changes in this past year affecting the so-called Blue Water Navy veterans from the Vietnam War, and the expansion of Agent Orange rules for those veterans. I also want to remind everybody this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, comments, and questions. So you can call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. And before I turn it back over to David, I do want to bring one thing to you veterans, bring to your attention. I was interviewing a new client today, and I was talking to him about it. And basically what it is, it deals with the mental claims. And I don't think you're going to find this written down anywhere. I've got this directly through some of my contacts within the VA dealing with PTSD, anxiety, and depression. In years past, if you filed a PTSD claim and your independent medical examiner came back and said, well, it's really anxiety and depression, or depression, which is secondary to a PTSD, but basically they were focusing more on anxiety and depression. So we would send that medical opinion into the VA. And the VA would then do a rating disability based upon that evaluation by the independent medical examiner. And you would get the benefit of the retro date. Let's say you file it a year prior to the doctor's decisions. Well, then you'd have an effective date of about 12 months. Well, no longer can you do that. Now, if you file a PTSD claim, and your independent medical examiner comes back and says, well, it's really anxiety or depression and not PTSD, if you send that in, the VA is going to turn around and deny your PTSD claim and tell you to resubmit or file a claim for anxiety and depression, because that's what is really going on here. The long and short of it is that retro period, that 1 year that I just referred to, would no longer be in play. So you'd be starting with a new effective date. So this is a recent decision, and I got this directly from two people at the VA who are decision review officers, who specifically on two other cases of mine told me what I needed to do to make sure that the mental claim went through. And so this is, you know, just new stuff. I've always said so much of what the VA does is to deny having to pay the compensation or limit the amount of time, amount of money that they have to pay in compensation. And this is just another example of it. So what I'm doing on my end, and if veterans, if you have a VSO or a VAV or you have a lawyer, you may want to bring this to their attention as well. So what I do on my end is I file. I'm not an expert. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. So I put the claim in for PTSD, anxiety, and depression. I put in all three. Can always eliminate one, but then you got the other two going forward. What it does is it preserves your original effective date, thus the potential retroactive payment. So that's just a little, little schoolwork there to kind of help you as you're going forward when you have a mental claim. Anyway, David, back to you.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks for sharing that, that insight. It'll be interesting to see how, the Board of Veteran Appeals and, the U.S. Court of Appeals of Veterans Claims continues to address that issue because, you know, the VA has in the past, and sometimes it's made appellate decisions, that same trap that you describe, which is the veteran, let's say combat veteran, comes back from the war, files a claim for PTSD, because he knows a lot of his symptoms or what his buddies had, and his buddies have PTSD claims, for instance, and then falling into the trap of, well, the psychologists disagree, and maybe it's depression or anxiety or some mix of other problems, and the VA then coming back and saying, well, you didn't exactly characterize it correctly. And as you said, there are ways to get around it, which is to address all the other symptoms, because some of these diagnoses have overlapping symptoms, and even a broader kind of umbrella term of, you know, the psychological disability, that term, to encompass other things. But it'll be interesting to see in the next couple years, next 3 to 5 years even, what the Board of Veterans Appeals does and what the U.S. Court of Appeals of Veterans Claims does with these sorts of issues. Because the Appeal Modernization Act, as I understand it, you know, changes the procedural steps, but it really doesn't change the substantive law. At least I don't think it should change the way it's written. I don't think it should be changing the substantive law as far as benefits. But I think my personal opinion is it looks like the VA is using these as the changes in the procedures as an opportunity to catch some veterans by surprise, and if they don't check off the squares and take, you know, jump through the right hoops correctly, they're just going to deny it. And I saw that recently in a case in which the veteran had not received notice of a compensation and pen exam. And it's amazing, you know, we all know how slow the VA is usually on disability claims, but it's also amazing how fast they can be. If a veteran misses an exam, they can issue a decision a day or two after that. It's like they've got the computer locked and loaded, that if they don't get that CNP report or if the veteran doesn't show up, they're going to deny it for that reason alone. And then therefore now under the new procedures is, in this case that I saw, the VA denied it and then said, veteran, when you're ready for an exam, contact us. Well, he did, and they said they'll schedule him. And then we get a follow-up letter saying that he's going to have to file a supplemental claim with new and relevant evidence in order to justify getting another exam, because now the VA has taken the position that he had no good basis for missing the exam in the first place. And his position is he never received the notice of it. So that's the sort of bureaucratic nonsense that the VA promotes. And Rich, as you said before, if they'd simply pick up the phone and call this veteran to make sure he, you know, that there would not be these sorts of problems. You know, what's interesting is that there's a disparity between the VA healthcare side as far as medical appointments and the VA disability side. I think, as most veterans know, if you're getting care within the VA system and you've got an appointment in the VA healthcare system, you will receive multiple reminders, including telephone messages, text messages, and written postcard reminders of your appointments. So it's really tough to miss an appointment, but it seems like with the C&P exams, they'll send out one notice, and if you don't get it for some reason, you could find your claim being denied and a really big hassle. So you got to stay on your toes, veterans, and veteran advocates really need to be aware of the pitfalls of this new legislation. But I've got some
David,
news.
One thing, as long as we're talking about this, I get probably at least three or four calls a day from my clients who tell me that they just got a notice or a phone call from, I'm going to use this one company, LHI, to do,
you know,
the contractor for an exam. And they say to me, do I have to go? That's the text. Do I have to go? And of course they said, of course you have to go. It's part of the process. Well, I don't want to drive an hour. Well, you got to call them then, but you just can't blow it off because you don't want to go. Like David said, you know, if you don't show up, that will get messaged back to the VA and, you know, God forbid they turn around and just deny your claim because you failed to show up for a examination, which leads me to one other thing. And that is the VA, in my opinion, will look to procedural ways to knock you out of the box, to deny your claim versus dealing with the substantive issues. So you can have a veteran who's got legitimate substantive issues, but because the VA is going to find a procedural way to knock you out of the box, that's what they're going to do, never addressing the substantive issue, which is, in my opinion, just grossly unfair and an injustice and just horrific concerning what the veteran has done for his country. So, you know, veterans, again, you know, we say this every year, and we're going to continue to say you got to be on your toes. You got to be, you know, you got to have your safeguards out there, and you got to think when you get your mail that comes into you. You got to think. You got to call the people who are representing you, and you got to act. And if you don't, then the VA is going to take advantage of that, and you know, you're not going to like the result. So back to you, David.
Yeah, and that's LHI, the contractor doing C&P exams. I've had a number of veterans in the Tampa Bay area that have had appointments with them. And one just recently, this one particular veteran lives in Seminole, Florida, which is part of the St. Pete area. He lives maybe a mile and a half, 2 miles north of the huge VA medical center there in Bay Pine, St. Pete area. He got scheduled for a C&P exam in Tampa, believe it or not. So he was going to have to go, you know, about 35 miles. He called him and said he just can't make it. He's got reasons, impairments why he can't drive, and it was going to be too much otherwise to get a ride. So they're going to reschedule it, but I'm kind of waiting cautiously to see what happens with the reschedule, because his case has been through the appeal system, and we've been waiting for literally years to finally get to this point. And I sure hope the VA and LHI don't use it to basically find an excuse to deny his case because some miscommunication or something. So I've told them document every call you've made about these appointments and follow up with more phone calls, you know. But A lot of pitfalls, though. Like you say, you gotta stay on their toes. Got some news of interest to veterans now. I'd like to talk about the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Act. The VA has announced a few weeks ago that as of January 1st, earlier this month, the VA would start deciding claims under the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Act of 2019. And that act is very important for these veterans that served in Navy ships off the coast of Vietnam. It extends the presumption of herbicide exposure, including toxins such as Agent Orange, to these veterans who served in the offshore waters during the Vietnam War. The law was a statute passed by Congress, signed into law June 25th of 2019, and it followed a landmark decision that was handed down by a federal court just earlier in 2019. That case was the Procopio versus Wilkie case. It was decided by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which overturned past court decisions which had been in favor of the VA. The court decision, Procopio versus Wilkie, was a pro-veteran decision, and one of the lawyers on the case, John Wells, will be our special guest on next week's show, January the 27th. John Wells is a former executive director. Now he's the director of litigation for the organization known as Military Veterans Advocacy. He's handled a lot of veteran litigation, been very successful, including on this Procopio decision for the Blue Water Navy veterans. And John will be talking about that decision, but also the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Act and what veterans and their advocates need to know, you know, in the months and years ahead as they, you know, apply for disability compensation from the VA. On a related note, before I turn it back over to Richard Hurley, the Military Veterans Advocacy Organization is hosting a special continuing education seminar in Tampa on February the 1st, 2020, which is a Saturday. It's a three-hour seminar. It's for veterans, their representatives, whether they're lawyers, veteran service officers, on these Blue Water Navy issues. And now's the time because, as I said earlier, these cases are finally being decided starting this month by the VA. So veteran advocates need to know really what's going on and how this law will affect their clients. So this seminar, February 1st, it's at the Marriott Tampa West Shore Hotel in Tampa, Florida. It's very close to the Tampa International Airport. You can get more information from the website militaryveteransadvocacy.org. That's militaryveteransadvocacy.org /reception.html. And our guest next week, John Wells, will be talking more about that and the whole issue. So that's a big change, very pro-veteran event, and we hope those that are in the Tampa area can attend that. Over to you, Richard.
Well, we talked earlier about the Appeals Modernization Act of 2017, which became law on August 23rd, 2017, and became fully effective in February of 2019 after an 18-month period of preparation and voluntary opt-in period for veterans. It's also known as the Appeals Modernization Act. And let me also explain some of you veterans who still may have who never opted into the new system prior to February 2019, your claim is what they call a legacy claim. And the legacy claims are not subject to the Appeals Modernization Act. In fact, if you are in the legacy system, you have a strong likelihood of success because in my opinion, I think you've got the VA a little advantage. Because they're trying to get rid of these cases. I have spent over the last couple of years a lot of time conferencing legacy cases. And unlike the cases that are in the Appeals Modernization Act system, the decision review officers tend to be a little bit more veteran friendly because they want to get rid of these cases. That's the bottom line, you know. I look at it as they're doing something good for the veteran. From their perspective, I see them thinking, I just want to get rid of this case. And if I've got to err on the side of the veteran, I'm going to do that. Hopefully that gets rid of the case and You know, so remember that, veteran. If you are not in the Appeals Modernization Act, then you're probably a legacy case. Tell your veteran service officer or the DAV or your lawyer, try to communicate directly with somebody at the VA. And I really believe that you'll get some favorable communication back and forth. But the new law, the Appeals Modernization Act, it modernizes the current claims and appeals process. It includes three review options for disagreements with decisions. It requires improved notification of the VA decisions and provides earlier claim resolution. And it ensures you receive the earliest effective date possible. Okay, so what are these new options for review? You have three options for review. Option one is the higher level review. Your claim is reviewed by a more senior claims adjudicator and involves a higher level de novo review, new look of the decision. No submission of new evidence allowed. The possibility of overturning the decision based on a difference of opinion and a clear and unmistakable error. The reviewer who identifies or learns of a duty to assist error can return the claim to the regional office for correction. You or your representative can request an informal phone call to identify specific issues. The form here is the 020-0996. You can write that down. That's the higher level review form. It's been my opinion. It is my opinion based upon my own conversations with decision review officers at the regional offices that this avenue for appeal is not necessarily going to be too favorable for the veteran, because basically you're asking another person to step up and say that the previous reviewer erred somehow. And generally speaking, they're not going to find that. Option two is the supplemental claim lane, and you can submit or identify new and relevant evidence to support your claim, and the VA will provide assistance in developing the evidence. Now, you can go ahead and file that and then submit your new evidence if you want, or probably the best course of in that option is to get your evidence and then submit the evidence with the form, or identify some evidence that the VA never reviewed before making their decision. One of those would be a statement of claim. David and I are big on doing a statement of claim for you veterans. And the statement is something that would be, it's very detailed, and it's your life. It's your life while you were in the service. From the time that you entered the service until you were discharged, and this statement of claim tells everything about what happened to you while you were in service. You are your best source of evidence on this point. And, you would just basically tell your story. And then you want to connect the injuries to what happened. You know, maybe you were a paratrooper and you got hurt jumping, or you were running PT during boot camp and you hurt your knee or you hurt your ankle. Well, you want to identify that. And more often than not, I have found in the past when I pick up a new case that a veteran has already been in the system processing, whether he did it alone or he had a DAV or a VSO, the one thing that's not in the file is this statement, and that's form 4138. And that statement's very important. You don't want to ignore doing that, because that's your testimony. You're swearing that this is what happened to me, and it gives you an opportunity to turn the tables on the VA and make them go back and rebut what you're saying. And then option three is the appeal lane for appeals to the board. This option allows you to appeal directly to the Board of Veteran Appeals. You can choose between three options: direct review, you have no new evidence and do not want a hearing; evidence submission, you have new evidence but do not want a hearing; or you want a hearing and you have new evidence and you want to testify before a veteran's law judge. In this case, you would submit your new evidence within 90 days of the hearing, or even after the hearing within 90 days. They'll keep it open for you. Unfortunately, I'm finding that this is the way that I'm tending to go these days. Whenever I get denials from the VA, I'm just going right to the Board of Veteran Appeals, because it just seems like the VA is passing the buck, kicking the can down the street there. And, I'm and I think, David, you would agree, that we get a much more favorable look from the VA than we would from the VA. So those are your different options for under the Appeals Modernization Act. And, you know, you need to sit down with your representative and discuss them thoroughly to make sure that the one that you want to pick is going to be the most advantageous to your claim. Unfortunately, all of these avenues, you got to have patience and persistence. You're going to be frustrated. But that part of the VA has not changed. And I don't care about, you know, this new act that's supposedly helping the system. The one thing that it's not doing is getting decisions any faster than it used to. All right, David, back to you.
One thing, yeah, that's great information, Richard. And one thing I would add is that, between the supplemental claim lane and the higher level review claim, as you said, the higher level reviewer, is just a more senior, more experienced, I should say, claims adjudicator that is supposed to take a fresh look at the evidence that was already considered, but they will not consider any additional evidence whatsoever. And the veteran is not entitled to a hearing, a face-to-face hearing. That used to be the case under the legacy decision review officer process. The veteran or the veteran's representative can have a one-time optional informal, as the VA calls it, an informal telephone conference with the higher level reviewer just to identify the specific errors, but they will not accept new evidence. They will not accept a written statement. They will not accept new medical evidence, a doctor's opinion, nothing. They're based simply on the evidence that existed as of the time when the first decision was made. So if you continue to send in more statements or evidence after that first decision, you better have attached a supplemental claim to it if you want them to consider it, because the higher level reviewer will not. And I've had that come up. The other thing is that these informal telephone conferences, what they mean by informal is they're not keeping some sort of a transcript, and they are relatively brief in duration. So you're not going to get a whole lot out of that, and it's not like a hearing where the veteran can testify. Like you say, Richard, in more complicated cases, certainly going to the Board of Veterans Appeals looks like you're going to get a fairer, more thorough analysis by a Board of Veterans Appeals judge and the judge's law clerk, basically, who will go through the case. But don't forget the supplemental claim lane, and that applies, as you said on prior shows, if the veteran has ever filed on an issue, even if it was 10 years ago and been denied and they're essentially reopening it. They don't have, like, reopened claims anymore. You have to file it as a supplemental claim with a supplemental claim form. So there's, again, a lot of traps, a lot of pitfalls with the procedures. The VA employees, I think, are still trying to figure it out in some ways, and same for advocates. But it's just, we'll see. Maybe the decisions will end up being faster, but I'm not confident that they're going to be any better at the regional office level. I think, from my perspective, the Board of Veterans Appeals decisions have improved in quality and accuracy over the last, you know, five years or so, compared to what they were in prior decades even. And maybe that's partly maybe better training and a turnover from some of the judges that have been there forever. So anyway, before I turn to some other recent news from the VA, a couple things I want to talk about affecting homeless veterans and also some employment resources. Richard, you have anything you'd like to discuss?
No, let's go right into some more news. I know you've
okay.
Got some.
Okay, good. Something that's an issue that we've talked about in the past is the issue of veteran homelessness. And our guest in 2 weeks from now will be Ashley Lowry, who is the president and CEO of just an outstanding homeless project in Clearwater, Florida. It's called the Homeless Empowerment Program, HEP. And she's going to be our guest to talk about the resources for those that are homeless, and including veterans, at their organization, which is, I've been there. I've known some veterans that have stayed at that homeless shelter. And as far as homeless shelters and resources, you could say it's almost like a five-star homeless shelter. They have apartments for veterans specifically, a lot of other resources. But on that same issue of homelessness, there was a news item this past week out of Washington where in Congress there is a bipartisan bill to try to address, try to chip away at this veteran homelessness problem. And specifically, the problem is this. There's been studies that have shown that veterans that have other than honorable discharges, whether that was an administrative discharge that's characterized as under other than honorable, which is sometimes referred to as UOTHC or OTH discharges, that's the worst of the three administrative discharge characterizations in the service. Or if they had a court martial and they received a bad conduct discharge or a dishonorable discharge, those veterans typically have very few veteran benefits. They'll have some, but very few. Excuse me. They might have some limited medical benefits, but they lose out on a lot of other VA benefits, including disability compensation in many cases, but also eligibility housing vouchers under a Department of Housing and Urban Development and VA supportive housing program. So that brings me to this discussion of this this legislation, which is, again, it's a bipartisan bill. It passed the House of Representatives last week by an overwhelming vote, 362-31, H.R. 2398. Now it's in the Senate. It still needs to pass the Senate. But some of the key members of the Senate Veteran Affairs Committee are behind this. In fact, they've sponsored the Senate version of it. And we all know the reality with Congress is you gotta have the support at the committee level or it's not going anywhere. So hopefully the Senate side will act promptly. But this is important legislation. Yeah, I think a lot of Americans, they will see people on the street, sometimes they're wearing old military uniforms, or they're not, or they just say they're a veteran, and they're homeless, they're panhandling, and they may ask themselves, well, how can it be when the VA is spending billions of dollars, how can it be that there are veterans that that are homeless? Why don't they go to the VA? Well, the answer to that is many of them have, and they've been told they're not eligible because they had the so-called bad paper discharge. Well, this legislation, if it's passed, and as I say, it passed overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives last week, will change that. It will make veterans that received other than honorable discharges, or UOTHC, under other than honorable conditions discharges, eligible for VA case management services under their homeless program, and eligibility for housing vouchers under a HUD VA supportive housing program. So this is really important, and hopefully it will pass. We've had prior guests on our show, including a guest from a housing project in the state of Florida, and that's partly funded by these supportive housing vouchers. So this would be a way that that these organizations that already exist to help veterans can help more of the homeless veterans. And again, studies have shown that veterans that receive these other than honorable condition discharges are far more apt to have problems, including homelessness. So that's a big item. We're going to try to track this legislation. Hopefully it'll get through the Senate and get signed into law relatively soon. Before we turn it over to some other news. Richard, any thoughts, maybe specifically on the homeless issues or?
No, but you brought up something that I'd like you to address, because we get periodically, we get these issues where a veteran has received a less than honorable discharge. And now he, you know, tries to go to the VA for benefits, and he's denied because of his classification, his discharge classification. And some of these cases are, you know, are pretty serious. And you get a lot of times, you get a lot of cases. I know my experience as a criminal lawyer, where you have a charge against you when you're in service. And, we could equate it to some, like a misdemeanor, something that's kind of minor. And then during the process, your lawyer, or maybe you didn't even have a lawyer, but they came to you and said, look, you're looking at 6 months in the brig or whatever punishment might be. But if you plead guilty to this offense or a lesser included offense, then, you know, we'll just slap you on the hand and send you on your way. Well, the problem with that is that you're not thinking, you know, you're thinking, oh, this is great. You know, I can get, you know, nothing's going to happen to me. It's no big deal. And I, you know, I'll get out of service and get on with my life. And then, like I said, you go to the VA and they tell you, you know, your discharge is going to prevent you from receiving any benefits. And there is recourse for you. Again, there are offenses that are more severe, and trying to correct those are kind of difficult. But we, like I said, we get a lot of cases. I'm sure there are a lot of cases still out there where the veteran really didn't do much, didn't do a lot wrong. He didn't get the proper representation. And you should pursue those. And David, this is something that you've been doing now for a long time, and you are, quote unquote, our specialist in our law firm handling those. And if you would, why don't you just kind of give a brief little background on those types of situations and what you do to try to help the veteran?
Sure. And there are, as you say, there are avenues to do that. There's avenues to try to upgrade the discharge. So let's say the person was court-martialed, and if they're enlisted, the two so-called punitive discharges that can be awarded by a court-martial are a bad conduct discharge or a dishonorable discharge. An officer, the punitive discharge is called a dismissal. The administrative, and any of those three will result in loss of VA, most VA benefits. On the administrative side, by that I mean it's like the military's version of firing someone. They're administratively discharged, and upon their discharge, their service is characterized as either honorable, which is the highest. The second tier is general under honorable conditions, which is sometimes just referred to as a general discharge. And then the third and the worst of those three, called an under other than honorable conditions, an OTH, or when I was in the Air Force, we'd call it a UOTHC for under other than honorable conditions discharge, which like the punitive discharges, will result in the loss of most VA benefits. Now, the recourse when the person leaves the service is to go to the discharge review board. Each service has their own discharge review board. If that fails, then to the Board for Correction of Military Records. The Army has a Board for Correction of Military Records. The Air Force has one. And then the Navy has the Board for Correction of Naval Records, which covers both the Navy and the Marine Corps, because, as you know, the Marine Corps fall under the Department of the Navy. So those are two administrative boards that a veteran can file an application with. But the word of caution about both of those is both of those put the burden of presenting evidence and the burden of proof on the veteran and the veteran's representative. These are not investigative boards that go out trying to look for favorable evidence. They will ask the military service, the military record system, to provide a copy of the existing service records for that veteran. But that's basically it. So the key to success is preparation. You have to do your homework before you launch one of these applications. And there are different time frames. The discharge review board, you have to apply within 15 years after that separation, and that 15 years is non-waivable. the Board for Correctional Military Records is interesting. It has a shorter 3-year period of time, but that 3 years can be waived in the interest of justice. So you could have a veteran that's been out for 20 years and missed the 15-year deadline of the Discharge Review Board, but can still apply to the Board for Correctional Military Records and ask for a waiver of the 3-year period, which, if they succeed on the merits, the boards are usually pretty lenient about waiving the 3 years. So you have to know, what you're doing and preparing for these boards. Unfortunately, a lot of veterans fall into the trap of, you know, they've been in the military, they're used to filling out forms, and when they're told they can apply for a discharge upgrade to get that honorable or general discharge to entitle them to VA benefits, you know, someone sends them one or both of the forms, either for the Discharge Review Board or the Board for Corrections, Military Records. And it's a, you know, it's a short, two-sided form. They think all I got to do is fill that out and send it away, and I'll wait for a favorable decision. Well, reality is, because as I said earlier, the burden of proof is on the veteran. And these boards are not sympathetic at all. These are staffed by, I think, rather cynical, government Washington DC based employees for the most part. And they've seen and heard everything under the sun. And, they're a tough audience. So it's very difficult to win these cases. I'm not going to sugarcoat it, but you will increase your chances of success remarkably by doing your homework, which is get all the records, develop statements, get statements from other people that can help build the case. And that's where a lawyer's expertise, Richard, as you and I know, in proving your case, like if you're going to trial, you're going to prove your case with witnesses, witness statements, other types of evidence that's relevant, legal arguments to show legal error, because these boards are looking for basically an error or an injustice about what happened. One of the biggest wins I had in my career, representing veterans with a Board for Correction case was an Air Force veteran who'd been kicked out at about the 17-year point, 17 years into a 20-year career. If he just served a few more years, he'd be eligible for a lifetime pension. Well, he got administratively discharged for a so-called pattern of minor disciplinary infractions, which were relatively minor. It was 3 or 4 incidents of things that really did not show a pattern of misconduct. They were kind of unrelated. They were all in the same enlistment, but they were kind of unrelated, isolated events. And in that series was one of the alleged pattern, believe it or not, was his wife writing a bad check to the base commissary, believe it or not, that they were held. There's this thinking in the military that you're responsible for your family members. And I argued, well, that's totally absurd but I had other legal and factual arguments against some of the other allegations against this guy. Long story short, we got this guy, not only did we get this guy's discharge, getting it upgraded wasn't even the full victory. We were successful in getting this guy reinstated back into the military with credit in the time during the appeal. So he only had to serve a very short period of time going back on active duty to get his retirement. My point is, it is possible to win these cases. You are dealing with, like I say, kind of a tough, cynical audience in these boards. But do your homework and prepare. Do not, veterans, just fall into the trap of filling out that 2-page form and sending it in, because almost certainly you're going to lose. So anyway, I hope that gives you a summary of that. And related to that whole issue,
David, let me ask you a question.
Go ahead.
That.
Yeah.
So let's say the issue could be ineffectiveness of counsel. I did a lot of criminal law in my 36 years as a lawyer, and that was an issue that periodically gets raised, maybe more often than not, ineffectiveness of counsel. How would that play out in the Board of Correction?
If you had ineffective assistance of counsel, first you would look at what were the circumstances that led to the discharge? Was it ineffective assistance of counsel at a court-martial, and the court-martial either led to a bad conduct discharge or discharge? The reason I say that is, if there was ineffective assistance of counsel at a court-martial, a military defendant is entitled to free and different appellate counsel in the military. And in the military, unlike a lot of states, you have automatic appellate review unless you affirmatively waive it. In other words, it's not a situation where you only get an appellate review if you specifically appeal. In other words, in the military system, there will be automatic review unless you affirmatively waive it. And my point being, if it was a court martial that this service member went through, then he or she needs to pay attention, because after the court martial, they, you know, and the military uses lots of forms and form letters advising people of what their rights are, and they make them sign to acknowledge their rights. That's it's very procedural as well, so that there is documentation. There's, you know, in the military system, you know, it's there's not a lot of new things that haven't happened before. So, you know, the importance of documenting advisement of rights, waiver of rights, all that stuff is there in form. So, but my point is, that's how they ought to raise it. If they were court-martialed, they need to raise it with their appellate counsel, who will be different from their trial counsel in every instance. Okay? Now, if they weren't court-martialed, but they were administratively discharged, they would still be, you know, they would still have received free military legal advice from a military defense lawyer before that discharge. And if they weren't properly advised, that's something that they could raise to the Discharge Review Board or the Board for Correction. But it's a matter of the burden. I said earlier, the burden of proof is going to be on the veteran to prove that, and to prove the harmful impact, and there wasn't harmless error, and all that, all the sorts of things that you would receive. And that's the sort of thing that I would think maybe you'd agree, Richard, that a veteran doing that really would need the advice, the assistance of another lawyer at that point, not something that they most likely are going to succeed on their own. In other words, to prove
sure
where the legal errors were made, et cetera.
Now, David, I would believe that there would be, there could be a, or should be a transcript with the proceeding as well, right? So the veteran.
Well, it depends.
Request a transcript.
It depends. It depends on what the forum was. If there was a court martial, there should be a transcript. But then you're also looking at how long ago was the court martial, because the military, you know, they have set regulations. This is not just at their whim. They have set regulations for records retention. I mean, they're a federal government agency, and they have to follow those rules. Having the transcript is the great starting point. And you really, veterans, if they went to a court martial, they would be given, they're entitled to a free copy of the transcript that they would have been given. So they better hold on to it. And the same thing if they went to if they were eligible, some administrative discharges, depending on a number of factors, they may have been eligible for an administrative board hearing, in some cases not, but if they're entitled to an administrative board hearing, there at least was going to be a summarized transcript, again, they would be given a free copy of that, and they need to hold on to it. That's the easiest way to make sure they have a transcript later, because if 10 or 15 years later they say, well, I've lost the transcript, and now I have to, you know, the government may not have kept it that long because under their regulations they weren't required to. Okay, there might be some in the records, in their personnel records, there will be a summary of what happened and the final action by the separation authority or the court martial convening authority. But the actual transcript may have been legitimately and properly disposed of years before. So anyway, that's just a practical.
Yes. So, you know, if you're a veteran and you did receive less than honorable discharge, you know, I know, it may sound like it's burdensome, but, if you feel that, you did not receive good advice from counsel or whatever, or another reason why you took a deal and that got you out of the service. It really benefits you to pursue it. Get yourself a good lawyer. Call David. He's great at this stuff. And pursue it because, you know, once you correct that, now you're eligible for all these, compensation benefits. So if you're a young vet, you know, from Iraq and Afghanistan, and, you know, there's no reason not to pursue it because you've got the time to do it. And in the long run, you'll be better off. So, well, thank you for all that, David.
Yeah. Well, we've got just a few more minutes left of the show. I'll add one thing real quick on that general subject of discharges. We've mentioned on the show previously an outstanding organization called the National Veterans Legal Services Program. We'd had in the past a representative from that organization on our show. But the National Veterans Legal Services Program issued a press release just a few days ago in which, in response to a lawsuit, the Pentagon basically caved in on a request that the Pentagon must make all discharge review board and correction board decisions publicly available, which is important. Because if you're doing research to try to see what these boards have decided in similar cases, it's important that the prior decisions are posted. And in past years, many of the decisions were, but for some reason recently, the Pentagon changed that and eliminated a lot of these decisions. Now, you might be concerned. Well, you might say, well, for privacy reasons, why are these decisions being posted? Well, they would be redacted of the person's name and identifying information because we're not talking about court-martial or public trials. We're talking about typically, for the most part, these are administrative actions. But anyway, that's a big success. And we thank the National Veterans Legal Services Program for being so aggressive as they always are in taking on the Pentagon and the VA. So, okay, just got a few minutes left. Richard, anything you'd like to add and perhaps share the Coaching into Care program?
Yeah, the Coaching into Care program. This is our weekly reminder to you veterans and their families about an important program called Coaching into Care. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment and loved ones can help. Coaching into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call, toll free, 1-888-782-3-7458. Hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, the VA's Coaching into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, once again, I'd like to remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has the Veterans Crisis Line. That number is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Richard. And just a reminder, on our show next week, January the 27th, our special guest will be John Wells, who is a retired Navy commander, spent a long career with the Navy as a Navy surface warfare officer, and when he left active duty, he became a veteran advocate. After he retired from the Navy in 1994, he's been a very successful attorney representing veterans and is the founding executive director and the current chairman of the board of the Military Veterans Advocacy. He'll be our special guest to talk about the issue of Blue Water Navy veterans and the VA. That's John Wells. And then on February the 3rd, we'll have Ashley Lowry, the president and CEO of the Homeless Empowerment Program based in Clearwater, Florida. And on February 10th, our guest will be Lauren Price, one of the co-founders of Veteran Warriors. She'll be talking about the burn pit toxic contamination issue. So we got guests lined up for the next few weeks. Hope you'll tune in then. I'd like to thank all of you for listening to tonight's show here on BBS Radio Station 1. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli and Corey and Hurley Law Group. And I'd like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Please tune in next week, same time, same station, which is 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 Central, 5 Mountain Time, and 4 p.m. Pacific Time on bbsradio.com, Station 1, for another edition of Veterans News Hour. Until then, hope you have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.